Hey there, welcome to Beauty at Work. We are in between seasons at the moment, so in the meantime, you can check out this clip from one of our episodes. What is mimetic desire, and what does it have to do with beauty? In this clip, entrepreneur and author Luke Burgess talks about René Girard's theory of mimetic desire and how it illuminates our pursuit of status and success across a variety of contexts from Silicon Valley to academia, and discusses what it has to do with beauty. Here's what he had to say.
So mimetic desire is a phrase that comes from a French social theorist named René Girard. So he was introduced to me around the time that I had this existential crisis I'm describing, where you know my work had lost some meaning. I wasn't sure, you know, why I was doing it. I'd lost some of that energy and that wonder. And a good mentor of mine introduced me to these ideas of Girard. And Girard's entire theory has to do with why humans want the things that they want. And he explored, you know, classical thinkers like Plato and Aristotle, who recognized that there's a strong role of imitation in human life. Human beings imitate. It's how we learn. It's how we learn languages. Mm-hmm. It's how we learn to be part of a certain culture. And imitation is this tremendously powerful force in human life. René Girard's kind of contribution to this perennial exploration of the role of imitation in human life is that humans' powers of imitation go deeper than external forms of imitation, right? Mm-hmm. Which he called imitating sort of the imitation of representation, right? Things that we can see, right, on the external surface. We even imitate the desires of other people, right? We read below the surface level and imitate what other people want. So we're social creatures. And mimetic desire, mimetic is just a word for imitation, right? Because it comes from the Greek word meaning to imitate. The reason that Girard didn't call this kind of desire imitative desire is because he wanted to distinguish it from kind of the kind of imitation that we're happy to talk about and admit, right? Like we mm-hmm. talk about imitating role models when we're children. This is very common. Mimetic desire, he said, it usually happens unconsciously, mm-hmm. right? We're usually imitating other people who are models of desire for us in some way, who are mediating desires to us in an unconscious way, because as adults, we don't always like to admit that we're affected in this way by other people. We like to think of ourselves as very independent and autonomous. And yeah. The heart of Girard's theory is that our desire by its very nature is social. We imitate the desires of other people for better and for worse, mm-hmm. right? This happens in tremendously positive ways when we're inspired by somebody else's, you know, beautiful desire, right? Maybe they have some kind of quality. Maybe they're a tremendous father or mother and that, you know, those are great desires to imitate, right? But other times we can be drawn into, to pay attention to bright, shiny objects, right? That other people model to us. Whether it's a certain kind of a lifestyle. And I realized that's what was affecting me my whole mm-hmm. life. I sort of looked around me and found models to imitate without necessarily knowing that I was doing that, which somehow caused me to kind of lose myself in a way and forget that original sense of wonder, that original openness to, you know, to the beauty around me, as I began to be hyper-track focus of, you know, career, financial stability, totems of prestige, right? Which in my world were, you know, having certain kinds of watches and things like that, right? As beautiful as they may be. It was kind of a search for status, right? And there was, and status always, I guess, seems like it might be beautiful, before you have it, but then you realize that the search is kind of empty.
Yeah, I mean you're reminding me of the work of Will Storr. He's got this new book on status, and he argues that everything we do is a pursuit of status, and we can't escape it. And even if it's the pursuit of, say, spiritual status, wanting to develop some sort of interior perfection, that's still a kind of status chasing in some sense. I don't know if you have any thoughts on whether we can escape the pursuit of status particularly, can we escape mimetic desire?
I think it depends on, you know, we should probably kind of try to define status then, right? Mm-hmm. Is status a state of being, right? Is that kind of what we're seeking? In that sense, I think that no. In that sense, there is no escaping mm-hmm. a search for status, right? We're constantly seeking a certain state of being. But status can be, we can seek more superficial forms of status and more grounded forms of status, right? And I think that's where the difference lies. And, you know, I view status as kind of a spectrum, a qualitative spectrum.
Another,
you know, this is not equivalent to status, but, you know, the word prestige is a very interesting one. Often we seek professional prestige. We seek, you know, our colleagues, right, to esteem us or to think that our work is important. And prestige can be a slippery slope because it literally comes from the Latin word for illusion, right? There's a great movie that's named The Prestige about two rivalrous magicians. So prestige being a sort of relatively abstract concept, the desire for prestige itself can lead us to, you know, realize how empty it was, because when is enough enough, right? When will we ever have enough prestige? It seems to be the kind of thing that leads naturally to the desire for more of it.
Yeah.
And there's no sort of, it's not concretized in the kind of way that we would ever know that we have the kind that we're looking for. And I think there's some relation to status there.
Yeah, yeah. I want to apply these ideas about mimetic desire, prestige, rivalry, and so on to the world of science and technology. And then they're different worlds, they're different industries, right? So the world of science and academic science, different from the tech industry. But one of the factors that seems to characterize both of them is competition and also rivalry, right? So in the world of science, one of the things that seems to matter a lot is getting credit for a discovery. And it's a really scarce reward. In fact, there's this priority rule where the person who reports a discovery first wins all the spoils, regardless of how many other people were involved actually in making that discovery possible. And some people say this has led to a lot of the secrecy and sort of, you know, hyper competition and so on that actually is bad for science, has led to the replication crisis and so forth. And the Nobel Prize is another kind of example of sort of a really scarce reward where only three scientific fields can win a Nobel Prize. And even in one of those fields, only three people could actually jointly hold that prize, regardless of whether there are 100 people on the team that made that discovery possible, right? So this is a question, I suppose, about, you know, I'd love to hear your assessment of the world of science and this sort of competition. Is this really a source of unhealthy rivalry? Is this bad for science and for academia more generally, do you think?
Yeah, you know, the broader discussion of competition, I think, is an interesting one. I come from the business world, right? The startup world. The word competition, competere, it just comes from Latin. That just means to seek together, right? To seek something together. So in business, I suppose that's profit, right? You have multiple, you know, businesses that are together seeking profit, right? So part of it depends on whether or not you believe it's a zero-sum game or not, right? So if you're seeking that profit together, if you believe that there's a fixed amount of it, then somebody has to win and somebody has to lose, right? If you actually believe that you can create more of it, right, that you can create new value, right, which creates more profit, then I suppose it can be a constructive thing, right? It can push people to innovate, right? Mm-hmm. And innovation is important. And there are many stories throughout history of, you know, competition leading to innovation, right? Because if you don't innovate, you die, you don't survive. So innovation is more than just this kind of, you know, we kind of wax poetic about innovation, but businesses have to innovate. They have no choice. Yeah. They don't innovate, they don't survive. I guess the same could be true in academia with scientists, right? There's good competition and there's bad competition, I suppose. And I can think of competition, you know, pushing discovery, pushing innovation forward through some kind of healthy, you know, competitive rivalry in some sense. But then other times it can become just silly, right? Mm-hmm. When, you know, the competition can be such that you forget what it was that you were interested in the first place. And it becomes more important to just, you know, publish in a certain number of journals or something like that,
right?
Where you sort of get distracted, right? Your attention gets diverted to the wrong place because, you know, the competition is for some of these smaller stake things, right? And where does that end? I suppose sometimes it's good not to have competition, though. You know, I think of a situation where I'm you know, working on a book, for instance, and if my publisher said, well, Luke, there's three other people that are writing books about the same topic, and whoever finishes the writing first will get to be the one to publish it, I wouldn't write a very good book, right? Because I'd be constantly worried about what everybody else is doing. Whereas if I had a grant and I had 2 years to work on this, right, and I could just focus on it completely, it's going to get more of my time and attention and thoughtfulness where I'm not constantly looking over my shoulder, you know, worried about winning this race. So in that sense, I think that for scientific discovery, I think it is important that people have a certain amount of space to be able to focus on the work and on seeking the truth, right? And be given the time and the resources to do that. Now, in regards to the winner take all kind of example that you used, right? Like the first person to kind of declare something that happens in business all the time. You know, winner take all markets, right? Mark Zuckerberg, you know, got it with a social network, you know. I don't think that's good, right? That seems like it can lead to people being motivated for the wrong reasons and not necessarily, I think people, even the way that ideas and work is framed can have more to do with a kind of framing things in order to be, to get certain kinds of recognition or credit rather than focusing on the work itself.
What do you think are, you know, perhaps more broadly, the conditions for mimetic rivalry versus sort of more healthy competition? Like what are sort of structurally those differences? If you were sort of, if you had the ability to say, set the stakes, whether say you were the National Science Foundation, you wanted to incentivize funding or, you know, some other way to control sort of structures of competition, is there anything you would do to sort of create healthy versus sort of this mimetic kind of competition?
Yeah, you know, an interesting distinction that Gerard makes when it comes to the different kinds of mimetic desires. He says that there are two major kinds of models of desire in the world. There's the kind of model of desire that is external to us, that we don't necessarily have contact with, that we can't really become rivals to. You know, this would be an example of this would be, you know, a doctoral student and like some famous you know, researcher who already has their PhD, they're sort of not competing for the same things, right? They're in different worlds, at least until the student, right, like becomes sort of on a level where he can compete with the master. The other kind of mimetic desire, or the other kind of model, is an internal model of desire. And this is somebody who's kind of inside of our world, right, who's very, very close to us. And that kind of rivalry can be, Gerard says that kind of rivalry can be dangerous because, you know, if we have two colleagues, for instance, at the same university who are sort of, you know, competing for the same recognition or something like that, that can actually lead them to not help one another, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to view all the resources as scarce. You know, in my undergrad school, we had, you know, something, it was a bell curve, and we all knew that there was only a certain number of people in the class that could get A's. And it actually led us to, you know, to not share our work, to not even help our fellow students, right? And it seemed to me to be a very unhealthy form of rivalry. So I guess, you know, creating the conditions in which people have trust, right, to share their work, to help one another, to work towards the common good, does require that they're not in a position where they're competing for the same scarce resources in some way. And I don't have the answers for exactly how to do that if I was, you know, on a committee with a prize or something like that. But I do think more thought needs to be given to this kind of feature of human nature, right? It's not enough to just sort of dangle recognition and money out there. I think creating structures and conditions that will foster cooperation and trust between the people that are competing actually is important, especially in that domain.
Yeah, because it seems like, you know, the work we're doing is looking at the role of beauty in science. And for a lot of scientists, they'll say encountering the beauty of not just nature or scientific phenomena, but the beauty of understanding. You know, when things come together, you gain an insight into how reality works. That's really what makes everything worthwhile. That's why you go into science. That's why you put up with, you know, long hours in the lab. And that's why you put up with even bullying and sort of, you know, sort of the harassment and some of the negative aspects of science and then chasing after grants and so forth. But the sense of competition, the idea that I have to get my idea out there, otherwise we don't really get funding and I, you know, lose my students and I lose my postdocs and so on. And that really sort of seems to undercut that ability to experience the wonder, right? I mean, which is kind of, I think, a little bit analogous to your experience, right? The initial wonder that draws you to do to do something in the world and to create something of value is undercut by those mechanisms that, in theory, are supposed to keep the engine moving, but it doesn't often happen that way. Is the world of technology similar? I mean, is Silicon Valley, I mean, that's a world that you're a bit more familiar with. I mean, how different is that from the world of academic science or academia?
I don't know if it's very different at all, right? Because mm-hmm. we're talking about, when it comes to mimetic desire, we're talking about kind of a feature of human nature, right? At least for Girard's claim is that this is something, it's part of human nature, and it's, you know, humans in Silicon Valley and humans in science and in academia. So in Silicon Valley, you certainly have phenomenons where, you know, you have, there's a first mover advantage, right? You have people that can tell a certain story, get an idea out there first, and they attract all of the venture capital money. They attract all of the attention. They attract all of the media, and it just fuels itself. There's a mimetic process that kicks off. And I think, you know, the same is true in science as well. To give you an example, I recently read that there's kind of a real controversy right now in Alzheimer's research, because a couple of decades ago there was some well-funded studies that got a lot of press and attention that linked the cause of Alzheimer's to a particular protein in the brain, and right, it sort of directs what I call hot capital, right, to this one idea, and they can overlook all of the other things that are going on, all of the other research that's happening, and for years, sometimes even for decades, right? All the attention is focused on this one thing, which can cause, you know, funders and researchers to miss other things, right? Because we're so focused on this one thing. So there is something to that. I mean, that seems to me to be dangerous, or at least can cause us to miss opportunity, right? Because we think that, you know, the understanding, the truth is to be must be found in this one area because that's where everybody else is looking. And that could perhaps simply be for mimetic reasons. That's why it's important to at least be aware that this mimesis works in pretty much in any domain that we're in human life.
Yeah. No, I think that sounds a little bit like one of the debates that's pretty live in physics, which is around the idea that beautiful mathematics for a long time has been seen as a guide to truth especially this past century, the first half of the century, a lot of predictions that were made just sort of betting on what physicists found to be beautiful turned out to be true. And then since the 60s, it sort of stopped working. And the argument is from the critics is something similar, that we're directing our attention to certain aesthetic criteria that worked for a while, that was really hot for a while, but now maybe it's outlived its utility. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious about what is the link then between that kind of beauty? Because really the folks who are pursuing this route of investigation are saying, look, the math is beautiful. It must be true. And they're led by a conviction about beauty, perhaps in some ways, not too different from some of these venture capitalists who are pursuing some sort of aesthetic judgment. And I'm curious to know whether the kind of beauty people find, how is beauty, I suppose, related to desire and to mimetic desire?
Yeah, I think we imitate models that we find attractive in some way. That we wouldn't imitate a model subconsciously or consciously if we didn't in some way believe that they possess some quality of being that we would like, right? So we're somehow attracted to them in some way. Now, I think there's a difference between attraction and beauty, right? So when I look at my own vocational journey, and I described a little bit of it at the beginning of this conversation, I sometimes wonder, you know, if we look back at our lives and why we were attracted to certain things or people that we were attracted to, and then we look at it 10, 15 years later, and that attraction might seem silly, like, oh, why did I think that was beautiful, or why was I so attracted to that? I think we can begin to diagnose some qualitative differences, right? And some of these things could be kind of a naive, adolescent kind of infatuation-like attraction. And other things could be rooted in something that's real, right? Like some objective beauty in something. I've wondered often whether the things that we find beautiful at different points in our life, if those are some kind of signpost to kind of what where we're going to find our ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment in terms of, a professional career calling or vocation. For instance, when I was a student, I had classmates that found solving math problems to be incredibly beautiful. One of my friends quite literally cried who solved a math problem, and he went on to get an engineering degree, and finds it absolutely beautiful in a way that I do not. And does that say something different about kind of the different paths that we've taken in life, right? I find different things beautiful, right? So I think there's a link between kind of understanding ourselves and the various things and reasons why we might find some things more beautiful than others. But I think understanding that these qualitative differences and why we're attracted to things is really, really important, right? Is there kind of in my book, I differentiate between what I call thin desires, which are desires or things that we're attracted to that kind of come and go, right? There's nothing enduring about them. There's no continuity. I might be attracted to this thing today, and then next week it doesn't matter to me anymore, as opposed to a thick desire, which seems to be rooted in something that has solidity, continuity. It's enduring. There seems to be something objectively real about that desire. And there is where I think there's some deep connection to beauty.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.